Could you open your Bibles, please, at John chapter 18? So that's the Gospel of John in chapter 18. Before I start, I just want to make an apology. For the last couple of weeks, I've said our service will last just over an hour, and you've not seen us finish till 25 past. And this week, we've had a threatened walkout at 12. If you do that, I will run at you and take... No, I won't. We're not going to finish at 12, but we'll try and... Finish nearer 12 than half past 12. That's my promise, that we'll try that, not that we'll do it. Okay. Open your Bibles, John chapter 18, and I want to work through this passage with you. We're going through the Gospel of John, and I want to ask you this morning who you compare yourself with. Do you compare yourself with people to make yourself feel better than them? Sometimes when I'm driving along the road and wanting a newer car, I'm quite happy that I've not got a car that's as old as the one in front of me or something like that. I compare myself and maybe make myself feel a little bit better, but then I compare myself with others when I go to the gym or something and I go, I'm never going to be like that because I'll never have muscles that stick out or whatever. And then I compare myself with other Christians. Some Christians manage to look like they've got everything together, husband, wife, 2.5 kids, they're dressed right, everything looks smart about them, they invite people into their house, they talk to them about Jesus, everything looks brilliant in this family, and you want to be like these people. So sometimes you compare yourself with people and you think, I'm better, it feeds your pride. Other times you compare yourself with others and you think, nah, I can't be like them. And all the time we're setting ourselves up for a fall. If we compare ourselves with people we think we're better than, pride comes before a fall, doesn't it? But then the other thing that happens is if we look at that wonderful family and say, I want to be like them, then all of a sudden the husband's left his wife and gone away with someone else. The kids are really just not that great or whatever it is. And we think, that was silly. They're just like us. They're human beings who are fallible and make mistakes. Why should I compare myself with them? Why should I try and be like them? They've let me down. And so what I want us to do today is to compare ourselves with Jesus. And we do that by being inspired by Jesus, but we also see Jesus in this passage in John chapter 18. The theme of this passage really is Jesus is in charge. That's what's happening here. God's in charge of this story. And we get to compare Jesus with Annas. We get to compare him with the religious leaders and Annas. We get to compare him too with Peter, who we see ourselves very like at times. But we also get to compare him with Pilate. But all the time, he should be our inspiration. So let's look first of all at Jesus as he's presented to us in this chapter. And what we see about Jesus is that he's confident, he's committed, and he's also compassionate as we just look at him. As we've looked at the Gospel of John, we've looked at it under the theme that these things are written that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing we may have life in his name. And as we look at this chapter, we've got more reasons than we had before to be inspired, to be confident in Jesus. Well, so what do we see about Jesus here? We see his confidence. We see that he knows everything that's going to happen, that he is ready for everything. Well, when he'd finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. So we've just finished that beautiful prayer in John chapter 17. Jesus leaves with his disciples from the upper room. And where's he going? Why is he going to these other places? Well, it doesn't tell us really until verse 4. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen, went out and asked them, who is it that you want? So what's happening is that as Jesus came there, he left that upper room, he left this place of community and love with his disciples, and he went out into this crossing this valley. We think that he's seen the vine as he goes, that lots of things are reminding him, but he's heading to this place where he often went. He'd often met in this place with his disciples. You've heard earlier in the Gospels that foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Tradition, not the Bible, but tradition believes that one of the places that Jesus often did lay his head as without a home was in this garden, that this is one of the places where he might have been. And as he's there, as he knows what's going to happen, Judas came guiding a detachment or a band of soldiers. He's got a lot of soldiers with him, perhaps 100 soldiers, perhaps more than that, but a lot of men are there ready to challenge Jesus. And so how does Jesus show his commitment? Well, Jesus shows his commitment as he goes to that place knowing what's going to happen to him. But then when they ask, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. He says, "I am he." Who's the one that goes out to meet the soldiers? Who's the one that puts himself forward? Well, it's Jesus. He went out and asked, "Who is it you want?" If the police were to come to your door because they were looking for you, you'd look at your wife maybe or somebody else in the house and you go, "Oh no, you go." The police often send people round the back door, don't they? So that both doors are covered if we try to escape. I've never had the police come to my door like that, in case you're worried about me, but I've watched enough programs to see how it happens. But Jesus went out. He showed his commitment there, and he steps out into it, and he says, "I am he." Now, you don't get this, and I didn't get this at first. But he doesn't, I don't think, just say, "It's me you're looking for." What book are we in? We're in the Gospel of John. What happens in the Gospel of John? What famous things did Jesus say in the Gospel of John? "I am. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the door. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the vine." He says these things. I think I might have missed one out. If I haven't, you'll remind me after if I have. But what happens is Jesus says, he says, "Ego I me" here. And "ego I me" is the "I am." And it's the last time Jesus says "ego I me" in the Gospel of John. Now, he could just be saying "it's me" because it's a way of saying "it's me." But it's John. And lots of things have double meaning. And what happens here is that Jesus steps out one last time and he says, "I am." And I think we're supposed to get that he is saying something really special. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. The soldiers are there. When Jesus said, "I am he," what happened? They drew back and fell to the ground. They went into a position of worship, a position of submission. And so you get some sort of sense that Jesus said, "I am he," meaning what we understand Jesus to mean when he says "I am," that he is the eternal I am, that he's the God who made the heavens and the earth, the one who was and who is to come, that he is the eternal God. Jesus says that. And he steps out. He's committed. And you can look to him and say, well, he is committed. And he's confident as he's the one who goes. And then as we look at Jesus, you see too that he is compassionate. Again, he asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth, I told you that I am he. It's me you're looking for. And if you're looking for me, then let these men go. Let these men go. Be with my disciples. Don't take my disciples. Don't arrest them. Let these men go." The compassion of Jesus Christ is shown here as he shows his care for his disciples. And we might think, well, wow, if these men weren't let go, then they'd have been arrested and killed as well. And what would have happened to us? Would we be here today in the same way if these men were all killed at the same time as Jesus? Well, the church wouldn't have the story that it has. These men were used by God to build his church. The Spirit came at Pentecost, and Peter, who we will look at in a few moments, is the one who voices the story of the gospel to the crowd. What would have happened? The church has been blessed by these men being let go, but that's not the reason that Jesus gives for letting them go. He doesn't say, let them go because I have a plan. He doesn't say that. He says, let them go. And John tells us this happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave to me. Let them go because that's my way of keeping them safe, not just now, but forever and forever. That Jesus is the one who is looking after his church, that he is the one who is looking after his disciples. And as we compare ourselves to others, as we look to him, but as we compare ourselves to others and as we find ourselves like others, I want you to remember this. I want you to see this as something that we are to be confident of in this passage, that Jesus doesn't lose his people. So as we make the comparison, we can be confident of the security that we have in Christ. The next comparison is with the religious leaders. We'll come back to Peter, who's mentioned just before them, but then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus in verse 12. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. So what's the story here? The high priests, as far as I understand, that the job was basically kept in the family. You think of where the priests came from in the Old Testament. They were from the tribe of Levi. And so what you happen is that the role is often in the family. And Caiaphas was at one time the high priest. Annas was the high priest, but Pilate's predecessor didn't like him. So we understand that Annas was sacked, basically. And then Caiaphas, his son-in-law, was made high priest. We think maybe two after him, the second one after him. But you come into this place where they all live. We're sort of thinking tribalism, we're thinking religious seat is sort of like they're not at all sides of Jerusalem, but they're living in this place. So there's a little bit of confusion as to how Peter ends up where he ends up later on. So it's just setting that ground that says it's very likely that the houses were all in the same courtyard, if you like, or facing onto the same courtyard, and that's where everything happened. And so this religious man still has authority. Annas is like the granddad of the high priests. So what he says goes. He's respected by the people, and so he's brought there, and so Jesus is made to answer him. And what we see in Jesus is confidence to stand up for the truth, confidence to do what's right. Move to verse 19. The high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. They're asking him questions. It's been really interesting. I don't want to bore people with election news because we could all bore each other with election news. But one of the things that's happening this election is some people are brave enough to show how foolish they are in front of Andrew Neil. Other people aren't brave enough to show how foolish they are in front of Andrew Neil. And so the truth is that we don't know what anyone's saying and whether we can believe it. If I was to ask you who to vote for, I've even seen two of you this morning commenting and basically saying we've got to make up our mind in a quagmire of trying to figure out who's telling us the truth, who we can believe. That's the story of the climate that we're living in. Can we be confident in our political leaders or our religious leaders? People lie to cover up the truth. And what you have with Jesus is somebody who does not lie to cover up the truth, but somebody who holds the truth in high regard and who doesn't give in to somebody who's trying to break him. What happens here is that the one who is always right finds a way of being always right and pointing out how other people are wrong, but he does it quite subtly unless you know what's happening. So the high priest questions Jesus. Verse 20. Jesus says, I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. Doesn't sound like it's too big a condemnation of Annas here, but it's a big condemnation. Annas, the high priest, is the one who's supposed to uphold the law for the people and be one of the people at the at the front of holding up the law, but he's actually breaking the law because he's just got this wee sort of clandestine court set up, and he's brought the accused, and he says to the accused, Jesus, what have you done? What have you done? Incriminate yourself in a way that will let me do what I want with you. What should Annas have done? Annas should have brought in some witnesses. The case has to be established in front of witnesses. And the witnesses should then go and should say, this is what Jesus has done and this is how he's guilty. Jesus says, I said nothing in secret. There are plenty witnesses. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. Annas, you're breaking the law. High priest, you're breaking the law. Religious man, you're breaking the law. And so that makes them mad and they strike him on the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? What right have you to call that man to the law? So you compare yourself with one of these people and you sort of say, oh, they make a mess. But then I want you just to jump to verse 28. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, the Jews did not enter the palace. The high priest and his guys go now to Pilate's house, and they get to the threshold and they say, it's dirty. That's a Gentile's house. And if we go into that Gentile's house, we will defile ourselves for the Passover. And that just shows us a bit of irony, but a little bit of hypocrisy and a bit of myself. When we compare ourselves to others, when we act on the basis of our religion, when we do what we want to get the way that we want, which is what Annas was doing at the start, we break the law. And then a few minutes later, we come up all holier than thou when we won't enter over the threshold of somebody's house in case we get dirty. And what I want to show you from this is that when we compare ourselves with religious people, we find that we're contrary. We're all over the place in different things. Every one of us, when we try and uphold a law, we find that we make a mess of it. And there's one law that we might be quite strict on, and then there's another law that, because it suits us and makes us happy, it fulfills what our selfish needs or something, we'll happily break it. That's what we're like. We're all like that. You know, we could be a Sabbatarian and we could be a heavy drinker. We could be a libertarian and we could allow people not to have different opinions and hold them to our conscience. We can be all over the place, and you could discuss this for ages and how we're contrary. But what I want to say to you is, don't compare yourselves to religious leaders like that. Don't look to them for inspiration. Don't look to contrary people to be guided by them, but look to Jesus. He was confident. He was committed. He knew the truth. He didn't give in. And so just keep on looking to Jesus. Now we move back to verse 10. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his ear. And then we move forward, and Simon Peter denies Jesus when he has the opportunity to stand up for him. So Peter is mentioned twice in this passage. Peter is mentioned twice, and both times, he panics. Panicky Peter. Panicky Peter saw that Jesus was going to be arrested, so he took a swipe with the sword. And I reckon it's pretty fortunate that he just managed to get the guy's ear. Because I've never looked at somebody's ear with a sword and thought, I'll cut your ear off. Normally, if you've got a sword, you try and cut somebody's head off, I think. But I've never had one. You know, it ended quite well for Peter, is what I'm saying. But he panicked. And then, just a few hours later, maybe, he panics again when a servant girl, a teenager, says to him, are you a friend of Jesus? No, not me. I don't know who he is. What is going on with Peter? Well, he makes a mess. He makes a mess, and he makes a mess twice. What's going on with you? What happens when you land in a mess? What happens when things aren't going quite right?
What happens when you don't know what's going to happen? Well, quite often you panic. You try and sort things out yourself. You have to fix things. And Jesus, put your sword away, he says. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? Peter doesn't know what's going to happen. Jesus knows what's going to happen. Jesus knows. Jesus is confident and Jesus is submissive. Shall I not drink the cup? And so what happens with Peter is that the man who is the most enthusiastic becomes the one who ends up denying Jesus. Let's just give Peter a wee break here. How many disciples followed Jesus to where he was there? How many? Two, we think. So one of the disciples went first, and then Peter is unknown to the people who's in the courtyard, we think. And so he comes in and they say, are you not one of those who are his disciples? And Peter says, no. And then round a fire, if you read the other Gospels, round a fire, one person asks him, are you not one of his disciples? And then another one, whose cousin or uncle or brother or somebody had nearly had his ear cut off by Peter, and probably has good reason to not want to be in the same space as Peter, says, are you not one of his disciples? And again he says, no, I'm not. And we read in Luke that immediately the cock crew and Peter went out and wept bitterly, but not until face to face with Jesus he realized what he'd done. He'd made a mess. That's what Peter did. And that's what we do. But I'm making a wee bit of a, taking a bit of a liberty here. Look at verse 17. Peter says, I am not. Look at verse 5. Jesus says, I am he. Now, the reason I'm taking a liberty is that it works in English. It's not the same in Greek. It's a different I am and I am not. But can you compare the confidence of Jesus? I am he. And he steps out. And Peter shrinking back and saying, I am not. Peter lets Jesus down. Oh, poor Peter. Oh, broken Peter. Oh, Saint Peter. Because that's what happens to all of us who believe we are made holy, we become saints. Why do we say that about Peter? Because I want you to know, and I want us all to know, as we compare ourselves today to other Christians and to Jesus, that our salvation does not rely on us not messing it up for a moment. Your salvation rests on Jesus saying, I am, and being the I am, who will always be the I am, the light and the door and the way, the truth and the life, and the vine that you've got to stay in, and the one who gives you new life. Your salvation rests on Jesus being able to say, I have not lost one of those you gave me. Our salvation doesn't rest on us holding on to him, but on him holding on to us. And I want you to look to Jesus and to believe that he is the Son of God, and that by believing you might have life in his name. Why? Because he gives life. Because he is life. And so you look to Jesus. So whoever you are, whatever circumstance you're in, whether you're panicking, whether you're in a mess, look to Jesus. It doesn't depend on you, but it depends on him. And trust in Jesus, the I am. Finally, we look at Pilate. Pilate is a man who is in control. Be great to be Pilate, I think, in a way, to have the big house, to have all the authority. But it'd be quite hard to be Pilate because he does keep the Romans happy, because that's his employers. He keeps the Greeks happy, but he also keeps the Jews happy. He's a diplomat, but he's also in control. He's under pressure from all sides. They all want him to do what they want him to do. And so they bring this Jesus to Pilate, and he asks them, what charges are you bringing against this man? They say, well, he's a criminal.
We wouldn't have handed him over to you. You know, trust us. We wouldn't bring you anybody who was just annoying us. Judge him by your own law. Ah, but we can't kill people, they say, the Jews, not when you're in control. But Pilate, we've been hearing, he must have heard that he's calling himself a king. 33, Pilate went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So the whole idea, as we read in this gospel and in others, is that Pilate was told that Jesus was trying to take over from Caesar, basically. And so it becomes a bit of a money question. Lots of our leadership and authority questions become money questions. But the threat is that he was wanting to take taxes away from Caesar. Now, we know that's not true, because remember, there's the story in the Bible when somebody asked him, "Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar?" Jesus shows a coin and says, "Whose head is on it?" Then he says, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's." Jesus is not taking from Caesar. You've got Jesus. He's been scourged. We think he'd been on his way to sleep in a garden. And he comes into the palace, onto the grand house, into Butte House, into 10 Downing Street, whatever you want to call it. And he's standing there before the Prime Minister or the First Minister, probably in rags by this time. "Are you a king? Are you a king?" Jesus doesn't say, "Look, do I look like a king?" Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." Jesus does not deny that he is a king, but he tells him that he is a king of a different sort. "You're right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth, to show that it's true that I'm a king. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." Everyone on the side of truth listens to Jesus. You know, let's get political again for a moment. If any of us were to have an argument, most of us would think we're telling the truth. And anybody with any sense of reason would actually listen to us, because, you know, trust me, I'm telling the truth. I read a tweet about it. That's the way we go. Trust Jesus always, because he is always telling the truth. He came to show the truth, and the I ams that he has displayed already, as he shows his power and strength and all of these things, he's building up this picture. Trust me, trust me, trust me. I'm in charge. Trust me, I can do it. Trust me, I'm not shirking from my responsibility. Trust me, I'm the only one who's consistent in what I'm doing here. And he is a king. And then Pilate asks that question. Look at verse 38. What is truth? It's a brilliant question that lots of people ask to get out of submitting to the truth. You tell people about Jesus, it's still a response. What is truth? How do we know what's true? And what Jesus is saying as we stand in front of him is, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And we should believe in him. This is what happens. Compare Jesus to Pilate. Who's in control? Not Pilate. The king is still the king. The king from another kingdom was crucified on a cross, was raised to life, has ascended into heaven, and he sits on a throne. He is a king. He's a king who always does right. A last comparison for you. We've looked at Jesus, we've looked at the religious leaders, we've looked at Peter, we've looked at Pilate. Compare Jesus with yourself. Compare Jesus with yourself, and who are you? I can see myself as religious sometimes and get that slightly wrong. I see myself pretty like Peter in that I want to be enthusiastic, but I'm a bit of a twit and a panic, and I try and sort things out myself, and I even at times do deny Jesus, do not give him the authority or place. And like Pilate, I would love to be in control sometimes. Control freak. Philosophical questions, all that sort of thing.
Then I look to Jesus and I can see his commitment to the cause of giving himself on the cross for me. I can see that he hasn't resorted to anything underhand, anything dubious. He is just in all his ways, just like God the Father. He's kept the law perfectly. He's done everything. He's fulfilled the purposes that he came for. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? And he goes and he drinks that cup of punishment, that bitter cup. He's fulfilled God's purposes, so I have a substitute. Somebody who took my place for what? For my religious misunderstanding, for not keeping his law perfectly, for being contrary, for sin, we call it. He has taken my place where I doubted, where I denied, and he hasn't let me go. And as we look at leaders, as we compare him to anyone around us, we see he is the only one who's in control. My hope, if your hope today is in anyone but Jesus, probably it's not in Boris Johnson or Nicola Sturgeon or some footballer or anyone else. It's probably in yourself. Because who else have you got? It's not in your family. It's not in other people saving you. It's in yourself managing. Well, that's silly, isn't it? Jesus is the King. One whose kingdom is not of this world. He's the King of Kings. And I ask you, if your trust is not in him yet, put it in him now. Trust in Jesus. He is the one who was and is and always will be in control. That's what John is showing us in John chapter 18. Let's pray.